Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Okay, I'm going to talk now to a woman called Cathy Sullivan, who's had an extraordinary life. In 1984, she became the first American woman to walk in space. She was also part of the team that launched, rescued, repaired and maintained the Hubble Space Telescope, which is documented in her book, Handprints on Hubble. After logging 532 hours in space, she was inducted into the Astronaut Hall of Fame in 2004. But that's not where the story ends, because just last year, she became the first woman to dive to the place called the Challenger Deep. It's in the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest part of the Earth's ocean. She's therefore the only person to have been in both outer space and the deepest part of the ocean. And Cathy Sullivan joins me now. Cathy, what a remarkable story. You were always adventurous. You were always very curious. Your childhood in California, let's start there. I mean, your dad was an aerospace engineer. In fact, your parents, the two of them, did they feed your curiosity?
Oh, they absolutely did. And they fed it with, you know, no editing at all. So both for my brother, who's a bit older than I, anything we were interested in, they would help us explore that interest with, you know, never a bit of commentary around little girls or little boys ought not to do.
Well, what you were interested in, I mean, if your brother wants to fly planes, you were into something that I must say I find quite fascinating too, but I've never taken it beyond my, you know, my house, which is you were fascinated by maps. And both your careers have been, you know, fulfillment of those early dreams, haven't they?
Oh, completely. I mean, it's talk about, you know, the dim inklings of a very little girl managing to come fabulously true. I mean, in spades, become true through a lifetime. It's quite remarkable.
It really is. Now, I could call you a Sputnik baby, a tomboy fascinated with how the world worked, etc. You read an awful lot about exploration, etc. We're talking here Mercury 7 with astronauts. We're talking Jacques Cousteau, maybe underwater. If you were a very inquiring person, an adventurer, and, you know, not just whatever, I want to be like them. No, that's not it. You just wanted to do it. Isn't that it?
There certainly was a bit of observing others, either people I read of in books or saw on television or magazines. It wasn't, I want to be them. It was, I wonder what it would be like to do that. I wonder what it'd be like to get to be in that place. What would it be like to meet those people if it was a National Geographic explorer? So it was, you know, it was not envy or wanting just to emulate someone, but it was a fascination with the kind of experience they were having.
Well, then I have to ask, at the time, you know, a woman, was it difficult to be the person you wanted to be in what was, let's face it, be blunt, it was a man's world?
Well, hearkening back to my parents, I don't think I got any signals from my parents that it was a man's world, that, you know, people do interesting things. You are a people. You can do interesting things. No one gets to tell you. No one gets to edit what you're interested in. They likely will have some opinions and some will say them loudly, but that, you know, they don't get to own what you're doing.
Right, of course. Yeah. And you studied oceanography. You have said that you had supportive male professors, but you applied to NASA. What did you apply to NASA to be?
I actually applied to be a candidate for mission specialist astronaut. And there were lots of reasons for doing that. The shuttle struck me as a space-going research vessel akin to the ones I'd been aboard at sea for quite some time. So I kind of knew I had the basic skill set to do this kind of expeditionary work. But the other big draw, the really personal draw that ties all the way back to the early maps interest, was I had just absorbed and inhaled every picture of Earth that any astronaut had ever taken. Mm. And if I somehow managed to beat all the odds and get selected, I would get to see that for myself instead of looking at someone else's vacation pictures. And that was just irresistible.
Okay, so you applied to be an astronaut, and the NASA class of 78, the first recruitment drive that brought women astronauts into the ranks, etc. Six were selected from the class of 35. Sally Ride in 1983, etc. She wrote about the unique challenges of being the first. Tell me about your first trip.
Well, I think we all had, all six of us had to deal with some of those unique challenges, because we did not train and run around together as a cohort of six. We were fanned out into very different work streams and assignments all the way along. So each of us was often rather on our own, just having to succeed and master the assignment, master the content. And I know we were all keenly aware that plenty of people were watching us, some of them probably skeptical, and keenly aware that you know, how we handled ourselves and how well we performed in a technical professional sense, all of that would have a big bearing on people coming, on women coming behind us. I felt like when we arrived, the door into NASA, it was ajar. We were not having to pry loose the locks or take the door off the hinges. It was ajar. And my hope was by the time we got done, it would be pretty wide open for whatever woman came along next.
And has that happened?
I think it has. I mean, it sometimes seems to go, you look back and it seems like there's been a lot of progress, and other times it seems like it's creeping along at an embarrassingly, astonishingly slow pace. But, you know, in my era at NASA, a woman as an astronaut at all was a big thing. There was one woman who had a very senior executive position at the Johnson Space Center, a stint as the director of the center. But I look now and, you know, women have been chief astronauts, women have commanded the space shuttle, they have commanded the space station, they've run the Johnson Space Center and other major NASA technical centers. So, you know, moving out of the secretarial, the administrative, the human resources roles into the roles, and it's really, you know, the roles of power, influence, and responsibility, those are the ones that really signify to me the progress that women is making. And it is slowly happening.
Okay, let's take it to where you really made history, which is October 11, 1984. You became the first American woman to leave a spacecraft on a spacewalk. You were trying to demonstrate the feasibility of an orbital refueling system. And you were 3 hours out there. I would have thought that was an amazingly long time. It's a very short time, is it, I believe?
Yeah, it's quite a short time as spacewalks go. The spacesuit of the day can do close to 8 hours, depending how hard you're working. So yeah, I confess to having a bit of mixed feelings about that. Some of my 35 classmates had been on missions before me with very long, very dramatic spacewalks, you know, retrieving and repairing satellites, flying a little backpack away. So the good news was my very first flight, I got a spacewalk. Any spacewalk is a rare treasure on top of a spaceflight. That was the good news. And the bad news was it was, in comparison, not as exciting and much, much shorter. And so, you know, such are the mixed feelings that come with life. But in the big scheme of things, it was a spectacular opportunity and a great vote of confidence in me. Spacewalk on my first flight.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what it is you're looking for. Not particularly exciting. I mean, it's astonishing what you did. I mean, 3.5 hours doing that. That's a four books for your life. Let's take a look at the book, actually. The Handprints on Hubble, which is, you know, an astronaut study of information. The whole Hubble thing, it's about being on the team that launched and rescued and repaired and maintained the Hubble Space Telescope. The Hubble Space Telescope, in a nutshell, it's revolutionized our understanding of the universe. Can I put it that way?
Oh, I think that's completely fair to say. And just a bit of a clarification, I was on the team 1985 to 1990 that prepared it and got it into orbit. And what we did relative to the servicing and maintenance, we built the toolkit and equipment that the maintainers who came after us would need. I did not ever actually fly on one of the missions that did the actual repairs. But that, you know, that was really, Hubble's alive and running now, and it's about, I would say, 1,000 times better telescope today than it was when we dropped it off in 1990. And that's all down to the tools and equipment that made it possible, not just to fix something that broke, but as better detectors and instruments and recorders came along, you upgrade all the electronics, everything on the telescope, upgrade it to state of the art today, rather than leaving it as a 1990s telescope.
Well, like, because of in-flight repairs and upgrades, it was all part of the plan. NASA was able to fix a serious defect in Hubble's mirrors, leaving therefore handprints on Hubble, and that's the title of your book. But when I say it revolutionized our understanding of the universe, are we talking about like new galaxies? Are we talking about knowledge of black holes, all that kind of thing?
All of that kind of thing, and the knowledge of new galaxies bit is one of the points that most dazzles me. That there's a campaign that was called the Hubble Deep Field. So imagine looking at the night sky and just with your eye or a simple ground-based telescope, and picking a small piece of the sky that appears to be empty, and then let Hubble stare at that for a long, long, long period of time. And that's what they did. It's a tiny, you hold your arm out at arm's length, and it's like maybe the size of your thumbnail, that little bit of sky. And when they did that, they found thousands of galaxies. So the images that come back look like, you know, look like a scattering of brilliant sand grains on a black background. You think, oh, lots of stars. And then you look at a little more closely, say, oh my goodness, every one of those dots is not a dot. It's a galaxy. It's another Milky Way by the thousands in a part of the sky that we thought before that was empty. That's just astounding.
So you're like, in a nutshell, therefore, did it kind of measure exactly just how far our universe is expanding? And it's something we could never really totally get a grasp of. We couldn't fully understand it, could we?
Yeah, well, no, there's a measurement called the Hubble constant, named after the same Hubble, which is about how fast is the universe expanding. And that had been measured from the ground, but, you know, not with very good accuracy. It's sort of like saying I'm driving at 40 miles an hour, plus or minus 20. Well, that's not a very helpful number. So the Hubble telescope, once it was in orbit, was able to refine that to a much more, 10 times more precise than they thought they were going to get to, actually.
So if it's the most productive observatory ever built, is it constantly being updated?
Yes, all of the servicing missions, the five different servicing missions, yeah, that were flown on the shuttle, even the first one, the big job of the first one was to, you know, fix the fuzzy mirror so that Hubble could see straight. That was the critical job, obviously. But even that one did upgrades, took up new solar arrays. One of the solar arrays was bendy and floppy and was disturbing all the observations. So they took that old solar array off and pitched it away, put a new one on. And that new array produced more electricity than the first one. And then later on, they've added other arrays that produce 20% more electricity, but are about a third the size. So absolutely everything. Think upgrading your cell phone, right? All the detectors that make our cell phone cameras have scientific equivalents. And with this repair capability, you could take the new ones up and improve the resolution, improve the precision, the clarity that you could see with, the range of the spectrum that you could work in, all of that.
Okay, well, handprints.
It's the only spacecraft, I would say, in the history of space science, the only one that has improved with age while whizzing around in the harsh environment of space. And that's a pretty remarkable thing.
Yeah. Indeed it is. Handprints on Hubble then. You can find out more on that, obviously. An astronaut story of invention on MIT Press. And we're talking to Catherine D. Sullivan. 51552 is our text. Now, Cathy, I want to take a look at this here, because to finish the space thing for the moment, you did two more missions. You did 532 hours in space altogether. You're in the Astronaut Hall of Fame in 2004, and it's as big as it can get, and that's a fantastic life. You can go and sit in your rocking chair and drink your coffee, and that's fantastic. No! The second part of the story is just incredible. Let's take a look at what I'm trying to say here, because it's just so remarkable. You left NASA in 93. You're part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, under Obama. You get an invite from Victor Vescovo, I think is his name. Tell me what happened and what did he invite you to do?
Victor Vescovo is an investment banker, a mountaineer, an adventurer par excellence. And in 2019, he had set out to build and equip a ship and a submersible so that he could dive to the deepest point in each of the five major oceans on our planet. And he decided two things he should do. One is take some notable people to some of these exotic deep parts of the oceans to raise awareness of ocean science. So take Prince Albert of Monaco to the deepest place in the Mediterranean, for example. And when it came to the Challenger Deep, which is the deepest point in the world's ocean out in the Marianas Trench in the Pacific, he thought, well, it's time to take a proper scientist down, and, you know, a woman should be a part of all of this. And so he emailed me rather out of the blue and said he was going back and did I want to come along, and he would like me to go with him and become the first woman to reach the bottom of the Challenger Deep.
We're talking here about 200 miles southwest of Guam, the Pacific Ocean, and you go down 11 kilometres, 7 miles below the deepest known part of the ocean seabed, the Mariana Trench, etc. And you go to the depths of our planet, having been to the very heights and beyond. So, last July, you were the first woman to reach the bottom, right? That's the eighth person, I think, in the whole world. Now, you have an unmanned robotic vehicle that accompanies you to the sea floor. Are you in a kind of a two or three person submersible beside it? Is that it?
That's right. We put three actually autonomous or robotic packages on the bottom. They serve partly as scientific packages and partly as navigation beacons, essentially. And then we, two people at a time, Victor and me in this case, got in a small submersible called Limiting Factor. I don't have all the dimensions off the top of my head, but I would guesstimate it's, I'm going to say maybe 4 meters across and slightly less than that top to bottom. And it's roughly the shape of a pillow, maybe 2 meters in thickness.
Yeah.
Inside of that pillow-shaped shell, there is a 1.5 meter diameter titanium sphere with 90 millimeter wall thickness. And that's what's going to protect us little critters inside from the crushing pressures outside. So Victor and I climb down a little tunnel into that sphere and close a hatch, and off we go down into the deep.
Okay, now you go down into the deep and you have to get back up as well. How long does it take to get down there? How long does it take to get back up?
Yeah, well, that will depend on each particular submarine and its shape. But in this case, Limiting Factor, as it's called, is 4 hours down and 4 hours up. It really is like a 4 hour long elevator ride. Once you get below where the waves are sloshing around, it's very smooth.
Wow.
It's pretty quiet. There's just, you know, there's bits of noise from the electronics in the submersible. But I mean, you can chit chat in conversational voice. You're not having to, not even like an airliner where you have to somewhat raise your voice to get over the engine noise. Quite quiet, very dark. And I'm truly like an elevator ride.
Oh, when you say very dark, is there any light on it that you can see what's out there when you get down there?
Below maybe 300 or 400 meters, no sunlight is penetrating. So the only light you will have to look around with is whatever is mounted on the outside of your submersible to illuminate the scene. And Limiting Factor has a very robust suite of lights, multiple banks,
high
intensity.
You're LEDs. 7 miles down in the Mariana Trench, the deepest known part of the ocean seabed, 11 kilometres. What's it like inside in terms of the kind of centigrade or whatever? I'd say it's pretty cold, is it?
Yeah, it starts to get quite chilly because the water outside, of course, is very cold, and that cold will seep through the metal of the sphere that you're riding in. So we were wearing, t-shirt under a Nomex coverall kind of suit. And then we each had brought along a ski cap. I brought along some gloves because my hands are always crazy cold. Borrowed a pair of down-filled mountaineer boots to keep my feet warm. There are heaters for the inside of the submersible, but every electron that you use to run those heaters is an electron you don't have available to spend more time on the bottom. Any adventurer and scientifically curious person is going to say, I can bring warm clothes. Let's spend the electrons for time on the bottom and doing science and getting to understand this place. So we did not use the heaters. We did not turn the outside lights on while we were on our way down for the same reason. Let's save our light for on the bottom. Such a smooth elevator ride on the way down that we nonchalantly ate our tuna fish sandwiches at about 30,000 feet.
Right.
And watched a movie on the way back up, actually.
Really? Can you remember the movie?
Oh, yeah, because Victor let us each pick the movie we wanted to watch. And I went for a great oldie, The Man Who Would Be King.
Oh, yeah, of course, with Sean Connery and Michael Caine. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's take
and
a look.
Christopher Plummer.
And Christopher Plummer, indeed. Yeah. Okay. What was I going to say? Yeah. So, there's huge pressure at the bottom, obviously. But you made a phone call, or did you? Did you ring the ISS? Did you ring from the Mariana Trench, the International Space Station?
We had thought about trying to arrange that call even while we were on the bottom. It ended up not working because of the work schedules aboard the space station. But, you know, technically, it would also have been very hard technically, because it takes 7 seconds. Our voice signal has to become an electronic signal and then sound waves in the ocean and then get turned back to electronics on the surface ship. It gets kind of garbled and takes 7 seconds delay. And if you think about that, if I said hello, 7 seconds later, the ship would hear me say hello.
Yeah.
It's sort of garbled, and then to the station. So we ended up calling back aboard the pressure drop surface ship after the dive. We called from the bridge. But, you know, still, you're 200 miles, you're hundreds of miles from any speck of land. You're standing there with a little telephone receiver at your ear and nonchalantly talking to two colleagues who are aboard the International Space Station. I don't even know what part of the Earth they were over during the time of our call. It could have been anywhere.
Just to look at the worst part of your career down through the, I presume January 28, 1986 is etched in your mind in terms of the Challenger disaster and the halt to the program and everything that went wrong there, the gases in the external fuel tank exploding after the rocket booster came loose and ruptured the tanks. I mean, was that a really one of the blackest days in terms of your profession?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, four of my classmates perished.
Yes.
In that accident. And a favorite person from the next junior class. And yes, then also Greg Jarvis, an engineer that somehow everyone manages to never remember, and Krista McAuliffe. So it was tragic for all of those reasons. And the, you know, fatherless children and widowed friends of mine, it was personally, professionally, the world I'm working so hard in and looking forward to continuing, and has just come to an absolute screeching halt, and is going to stay halted for quite some time. And the uncertainty about, will it start again? What will it take to start again? When will it start again? That's going to be months and months clarifying itself. So yeah, it was sad. It was depressing. It was, you know, angering and then just bewildering and disorienting.
Well, and by the way, just when you say angering, it could have been easily prevented, do you think?
I guess the accident report makes clear, and certainly my observation following the hearings and things, that there were competent, cognizant engineers responsible for the solid rocket booster system clearly failed in their responsibility to understand and communicate about their system. And I think that's not just the working level engineer. My view, it goes up to the quite senior leaders as part of NASA that they were involved in, that had, in my view, political and pride motivations for not being fully forthcoming on things that were that critical. And that is just unforgivable.
Indeed. 532 hours in space. What's your abiding memory, Kathy?
Two things I would say. My very, very, very first glimpse of the Earth, so 8.5 minutes after we lifted off, it's just absolutely unforgettable. And then the most memorable, very memorable thing from my spacewalk is hanging off the space shuttle as if I was hanging from the limb of a tree, and looking down at my toes and seeing a very distinct peninsula of Venezuela sliding beneath my boots. That was one of those, ooh, look where you are.
Yeah, that's not any kind of experience I've had. So listen, finally, Kathy, I just want to mention that, like, going right back to the very beginning, your parents, do you think that you started out with a fantastically curious mind, but that you were really lucky to have the parents you had?
Absolutely, completely. I come across now, I'm sure, as a very competent and confident, you know, unshakable woman. But, you know, at 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or even 14, 15, you're not any of those things yet. A brushback pitch, a sharp word, a demeaning or insulting comment from someone who matters to you can do more than put you on your heels. It can stop you in your tracks. My parents very carefully and very thoughtfully never did that. So they were holding the doors open for me to move through, and leaving it to me to pave my way and make my way. But yes, they're absolutely essential to the success that I've enjoyed.
Okay, well, listen, thank you so much indeed. It's fascinating stuff. And by the way, just in terms of the book, first of all, Handprints on Hubble, An Astronaut Story of Invention, that's the MIT Press. Catherine D. Sullivan, Cathy Sullivan. Cathy, is there any Irish in the background? I have to ask. It's a very Irish name.
Oh, well, and the other surnames in my family are Barry, Kelly, and Weir. So, yeah, there's just a little bit of Irish. And in fact, if I may, I'll give a shout out to my cousins, Nora and Margaret, who still live in Upper Lorrick, just outside of Kenmare.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Well, listen, onwards and upwards. We have this book. I'm sure we'll get a book about 7 miles, 11 kilometres down the Mariana Trench. So thank you so much, Cathy, for talking to us on the programme today. And congratulations.
Thanks. Pleasure being with you.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.